cell, once this cell divides, and this second cell is farther away from those cells that are secreting the substances that promote proliferation, then this cell has a better likelihood that it will differentiate. And the farther away it gets from that niche, the more likely it is to differentiate, because it is farther away from those molecules that are being secreted by the cells of the niche. Okay. So, we have fertilization. The egg begins to divide. I should say the zygote, the egg and the sperm begin to divide. You get multiple cells. And something very special happens at the 16-cell stage. You have 8 cells inside and 8 cells outside. Those cells that are on the inside will become the inner cell mass, that is marked here in orange, or the ICM. And those cells that are on the outside will become the trophoblast, or the embryonic contribution to the placenta, right? So the placenta has got actually regions that are contributed by the mother and regions that are contributed by the embryo. This would be the embryonic contribution to the placenta called the trophoblast. So it turns out that at the 8-cell stage, all of the cells express this master regulatory gene called CDX2, and this master regulatory gene that we've already spoken about, OCT4. At the 16-cell stage, those cells that are inside in the middle will continue to express OCT4, and those cells that will be on the outside, so if we have the inner 8 cells, will express OCT4, and that outer layer of cells will express CDX2. Once this occurs, they will then inhibit each other. Okay? So you can see that here. CDX2 inhibits OX4 in the outer 8 cells, and OX4 inhibits CDX2 in the inner 8 cells. In addition, you have an additional transcription factor. I should mention this also is a transcription factor, CDX2. There's an additional transcription factor called esomesoderm that is responsible or is a master regulatory gene for turning on all of those genes that need to be turned on in order for those cells to become trophoblast. Okay, so this is a master regulator for trophoblast. I already spoke about the fact that OCT4, together with NANO, okay, and in the previous picture you saw there was SOX2 also, but here we have a fourth player called STAT3. All four of those transcription factors are important for the early embryonic stem cells, as you can see here, and their development and their continued proliferation without differentiation. Okay, so we see that we've got all kinds of different genes being turned on in different places. What is doing this regulation? Well, we see from what we know, we're always being researchers and trying to classify things. We're always busy classifying things. So if we want to try to classify what are the various types of regulation, we put them into 3 categories. The first category, which Dr. Moshevitz has already spoken about, is that transcription factors turn on other genes to cause proteins to be made. So my first category will be transcription factors. The second category is histone modifications. So I'm going to write that up. So Dr. Moshevitz has spoken to you about these histone modifications, but first of all, about the histone structure, about the fact that there are 8 histones, there's 4 different histones, there's 2 copies of each to make an octamer protein, and you can see that here, Okay? These are the histones, and there are almost two complete circles of DNA wrapped around these histones. And she talked also about the fact that there are two different major types, okay, or structures of the chromosome. They can either be very tightly bound and not transcriptionally active at all. Okay, we call that heterochromatin. Okay, talk about that with the centromeres and with the ends of the chromosomes. And then we have the other type, which is transcriptionally active at some time during development or in the adult. We call that euchromatin. And that's not either a, you're either euchromatin or you're not. There are all kinds of levels of euchromatin. You can be loose euchromatin, which is transcriptionally inactive most of the time, but as long as it's in that state of loose euchromatin. Or you could have it be a little bit looser, or it could even be loosest. And using loosest euchromatin corresponds with active transcription. Whereas loose euchromatin would correspond with inactive transcription at the moment. Okay? So what are some of the things that happen that cause the chromatin to either be more tightly bound around the DNA or more loosely bound? And what we see is that there are these tails of the histones. You see one here in blue and one here in yellow that are protruding out from the DNA. Okay. These are tails of the histones, so these are amino acids. And I know that Dr. Moshewitz spoke about the fact that, for example, these tails can be phosphorylated during mitosis to cause chromatin condensation. Okay. But also that, for example, they can be acetylated, and acetylation would cause the DNA to be more loosely bound around the histones. So a third possible modification, and this obviously is not all the possibilities, but the third possible modification is methylation. And methylation isn't quite so simple. You can either have that the methylation would increase transcription or decrease transcription, and it really depends on which of the amino acids on these histone tails are methylated. And so for a while now, it's been known that if you look at histone 3, okay, so I'll call it H3, and you look at its tail that's protruding out, if you count from the ends, 1, 2, 3, 4, there is a lysine there, okay, and lysines frequently are methylated. Now, because of the problem that there are two amino acids that start with L, leucine and lysine, when they went through and gave every amino acid a letter name, leucine had already taken the L, so they call lysine K. Don't ask me why, and they just came up with that letter. So lysine is actually called K. So if this is a fourth amino acid from the end, we're going to call this K4. And what they see is that when K4 is methylated, okay, I'm just going to draw a carbon to signify that, that causes an increase in transcription, where it causes the chromatin to loosen up to allow transcription. So this is an increase in transcription. But it turns out, in addition, that there is another lysine at position 27. That when it's methylated, it causes transcription to decrease or to have the DNA more tightly bound around the histones. Decrease transcription. Okay? So we kind of have ourselves a code here. So researchers look to see what was the methylation pattern of the histones that are wrapped around the locuses of the master regulatory genes. They wanted to see what was going on. The first thing they did is they looked at ES cells, okay, embryonic stem cells. What you would guess ahead of time is that because you don't want those master regulatory genes to turn on, for example, the program of heart, okay? You're still pluripotent. You have all, you know, you don't have, you want to have all the possibilities. that when you look at ESLs, the master regulator for, let's say, heart muscle, MKX2.5, right, should be very tightly bound, okay, if you were guessing. In other words, would have K27 methylated, but K4 not methylated. Well, when the researchers actually looked and saw what was going on, they found that both K27 and K4 were methylated in embryonic stem cells. Not what you'd expect. So let me just start a chart so we can look and see what's going on. Remember SC being stem cells? Characteristics of a heart muscle cell. What would though be the situation for the histones around the locus of MKX2.5 for that DNA in the lens? Right? You remember, every cell is going to have the gene for MKX2.5. So what are the modifications on the histones that wrap around this locus in the lens? So you want to have MKX2.5 turned off. The way to do that is to methylate K27, but not K4. Now let's do the reverse. Let's take the master regulatory gene for lens. Methylation in embryonic stem cells of K4 and K27?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So which one would be methylated in the heart of the histones that are wrapped around the locus for PAC6? K27, because you want it off. And which one would be methylated for PAC6 in the lens? K4. Okay, so now in the handout, 13A, there's a New York Times article about what these researchers found. In addition, the last page of your handout is a chart that is very similar to this chart, but it's much larger, okay? It includes a lot more factors that we talked about here in class. Okay, you can run that we didn't talk about, but I've specified what it's the master regulator for. And I'd like you to try to fill those out for Tuesday, and then I will go over that chart on Tuesday. Any questions still here? Yeah.
I'm sorry. Did you say before that all of those four genes were present, the OP4, CDX2 nanogene, STAT3 were all present up until the 16, or were all being expressed up until the 16 cells, please?
No. So OP4 and CDX2 are expressed in all of the 8 cells of the 8 cell stage. At the 16 cell stage, a decision is made. And the 8 internal cells express OP4, the 8 external cells express CDX2. Okay, so we said that which proteins will be turned on depends on two things. First of all, we said transcription factors. Second of all, we said histone modifications, and we spoke primarily about methylation. You know, you can add that. So, of course, the others contribute too. And there's a third level of regulation. I see that I've written my histone 3 here in the way, so I will put number 3 over here. And that is DNA methylation. And I will get to that in another moment. I just wanted first, before I go on to that, to show you that the transcription factor regulation and the histone modification, or even the DNA methylation, which I haven't gotten to yet, can actually be intertwined and affect each other. And I'd like to show you an example of that. This word, epigenetic. Okay? So epigenetic is any change in the chromatin that doesn't affect the base pair sequence of the DNA or the DNA sugar phosphate backbone. And so it can be DNA methylation, it can be histone modifications, all of those are included in epigenetic changes. So, if we look at the development of the embryo, and let me just show you, this is fertilization, the zygote, the 4-cell stage. The morula here would really just be between the 16 to 64 cell stage is called morula. And here you see the picture that I showed you before where you have this, where the embryo has progressed further so that you have an inner cell mass and the external trophoblast or the embryonic contribution to the placenta. So, we start off, if you look across, this is, would be for the inner cell mass, okay? And here would be for, now they've written here trophoectoderm. This is just the trophoblast. Don't let this different word confuse you. Okay, the same as trophoblast. You see here that you have in both cells, of course, the gene A, okay? The question is whether or not its transcription is turned on or not. So you see when you begin, in both of these cell types, the transcription is turned off. But you'll notice that there is a histone modification in both of these cases that is denoted here as an oval. And so these cells are the same at this point. There is, during the morula stage, some of the cells, the ICM cells, receive another, an additional signal that is also a histone modification that is denoted here by the red oval. So in the ICM cells, you have these two modifications, whereas in the trophoblast, you only have the one modification. When we get, for example, to the stage now where you have a blastocyst, there's a transcription factor that's turned on, but it can only bind to the DNA when you have both of these modifications. When it binds, it then turns on the expression of gene A. So the expression of gene A would be turned on in the ICM, but because that second modification does not exist in the trophoblast, it cannot bind and the gene is not turned on. Okay? And so this kind of shows you how these serial signals are going to have different effects, and different genes are going to be turned on in the ICM rather than what's going to be turned on in the trophoblast. Other genes will be turned on there. So now I'd like to get back to this idea of the third possible way of regulating gene expression, and that's of DNA methylation. And what we see is that if we look in mammals, we see that what is primarily methylated in mammals are C's that are followed by G's. Okay, now it's different, nucleotides are methylated in different organisms, but in mammals we see that it's C's that are followed by G's. Okay? And this methylation of the DNA usually decreases transcription. And so here, if we have a cytosine, we could then add a methyl group, which you can see here, and the DNA would be methylated. So if we look at an example of how this occurs during development, I've chosen as an example the mobile genes. And it turns out that during development, at about 6 weeks, epsilon globin is expressed. Okay, its promoter is not methylated. Whereas at 6 weeks, the gamma globin gene is not expressed, and its promoter is methylated. If we then look at this same region of DNA at 12 weeks, when normally gamma globin is expressed, we see that the gamma globin promoter is not methylated or active, or active transcription happening here, whereas the epsilon globin gene's promoter is methylated, and we do not have transcription. Now, I'd like to also mention that most of these modifications that we're talking about are actually maintained through mitosis, okay? So the histone modifications would remain through mitosis, right? So once a modification has occurred, even though you're having multiple cell divisions during development, you maintain these modifications through mitosis. You also maintain these DNA methylations. And one of the things that's interesting is we see that there's an enzyme that methylates DNA preferentially when the other strand is already methylated. So what does that mean? If we have two strands of DNA, when I say that, I just mean it's a double-stranded DNA, and we have here C followed by G. The sequence on the other strand is going to be complementary and is going to be G also. So if, when division occurs, each cell gets one of these strands of DNA, and you have replication, if this CG is already methylated, then when the other strand is made, and the enzyme sees that this CG is methylated. I'm confused the order. One second. So, two strands. So, one strand, okay, during division, the one strand, okay, has CG and the C is methylated. When the other strand, okay, what we'll see, you'll have here GC, then the enzyme will preferentially methylate this C because the other strand has a methylated C. So there is a mechanism to retain this methylation through mitosis. Okay, so to summarize that, you can see that here, that you have multiple levels that can affect gene expression. Transcription factors can bind to the DNA. The DNA can be methylated. You'll notice this here says CG, CG regions. Okay? You'll notice that the complementary strand is also methylated. And you can also, then, once this gets wrapped up into chromatin, you can then have also the histone tails are methylated. Obviously, they can also be acetylated and phosphorylated. We talked about those, but we specifically spoke about methylation. Okay. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about the how we categorize the stages of this slow process of faith formation.
Number three over there.
If I transplant this cell into this region that will now become belly, and it says, I don't care, I've already decided to become that. And I realize cells don't decide, but bear with me. Okay? I'm going to turn on the genes, okay, for and make the proteins to become back, regardless of the fact that I'm now located in a region that would normally become belly. That's called determined, or number four. Okay. So I've spent a lot of time talking to you about how cells decide which proteins to make, which as a result will decide how those cells function. And in general, cells start at the beginning at the pluripotent stage and progress through the five steps I've shown you and become differentiated. It is true that I've said they do it at different times in development, but that's pretty much the scheme. Well, it turns out that there is one kind of an exception. It's an artificial exception in that we, as researchers, have tested the system, you could say, and tried to see what would happen if we took a terminally differentiated cell, so totally differentiated, okay? We took that cell, we took out its nucleus, and put it into an egg, and looked to see, could we start at the beginning of that fate determination process? Okay? And this is really what they did with cloning, okay? So it turns out that the egg, and this is something that was kind of part of the question that was asked here in the beginning, the egg is, on the one hand, pluripotent, can become every cell of the body once it gets fertilized, and yet it has some special characteristics about it. So it is kind of something special. And one of those characteristics about it is that it knows how to reprogram the DNA to start over. Okay? Whatever those modifications are, the transcription factors that bound, the methylation patterns, the methylations of the DNA, or the methylations or phosphorylations of the histones. Okay? So it's something very special about it. It knows how to wipe it clean and start over. So, in 1997, Ian Wilmot was actually able to clone a sheep named Dolly. And this sheep grew up to give birth to Bonnie. So what did they do? How did they get, this is artificial obviously, but I'm going to see this in nature, how did we get a differentiated cell to go back to the beginning? And that's actually on your handout, 13B. Okay, so to start off, just so that we're all on the same page, I'd like you to realize that we used three sheep in order to do this. Okay? The first two sheep that I'll talk about were from two different strains of sheep. We'll call this one the black sheep and this one the white sheep. You'll understand as we go along why they used two different strains. What they did is, from the black sheep, they took an egg and they removed its nuclear DNA. Okay, they removed the DNA here at the mitotic spindle. And then they took a fully differentiated cell from the udder of the white sheep and took just the nucleus. I realize that it says here cell. I'd like you to replace that with the word nucleus. Took the nucleus from those cells. Well, took one nucleus, I should say. I'm sorry. One nucleus. And put it together with that egg. And then to help them fuse, zap that with electricity, and let that cell begin to divide. Once it got to the blastocyst stage where it has this ICM and the trophoblast, they put it back into a third sheep, a black sheep. Now, if you remember, both the egg was taken from a black sheep, and the surrogate mother is a black sheep. And they looked to see if the nuclear DNA that was being used to make Dolly was of a white sheep, and a white sheep resulted, that would indicate that the DNA that was being used, they transcribed and translated to make proteins, was that of the white sheep, or this somatic cell that had been fully differentiated or had gone down that path of differentiation that we've been talking about in the last hour. And they saw that, in fact, Dolly was the strain of the white sheep. Now, if we think about that a little bit, it would mean that the nuclear DNA is from the strain of the white sheep. What about the mitochondrial DNA? Where should that be from? So from the black sheep. So in other words, Dolly would have mitochondrial DNA from the black sheep and nuclear DNA from the white sheep. So is this really a perfect clone? Like we talk about identical twins. They would have the same nuclear DNA and also the same mitochondrial DNA. Whereas Dolly has mitochondrial DNA from a different source than her nuclear DNA. Huh, isn't that kind of interesting? So what happens? A number of years ago, a researcher named Huang from South Korea claimed that he had cloned humans. Wrote this in Nature, big splash, I'm sure you all heard about it. And then there were some suspicions began to arise as to whether or not he had actually cloned humans. What he had done is he had taken cells that had developed to a certain stage and frozen them in liquid nitrogen. Okay, that these ones that he said that he had cloned. And so what Nature did is they went back and they looked at those cells to see if the nuclear DNA was from a different source than the mitochondrial DNA. In order for this to be somatic nuclear transfer, which is what he claimed to have done, this process here, it's called somatic nuclear transfer, is you take a somatic nucleus, you transfer it into an egg. If he claimed that he cloned a human using somatic nuclear transfer, he would have to have that the DNA from the nucleus was from one individual, and the mitochondrial DNA was from a different individual. But it wasn't. Was from the same individual, and that's how they knew that he hadn't actually cloned a human. That was the test that Nature did. Okay, so this information is actually very important and has some implications, and it's an interesting thing to think about. Okay, any questions before I go on?
Why isn't it possible to transfer mitochondria as well?
Transfer all of the cytoplasm, right? Because they're dispersed all over the cytoplasm. And you really want to have the egg cytoplasm because it's the one that's reprogramming everything. That's what's going to allow you to actually go back to the beginning of this differentiation program. So you really need the egg cytoplasm, and it's got all those mitochondria. You have to go in and pick them out and put in new ones.
Which is technically very good.
Okay? Yes? They could, but it wouldn't have proved as well that they would, because then it would be both of them white strained. And it wouldn't have proved this what they were trying to show, which was that the DNA that translated and transcribed the proteins was different than what the egg originally had. Because in that case, they'd be the same. So that they couldn't, experimentally that wouldn't be nearly as astounding. Now, what also they saw, which was very important, you have to understand that not only was it interesting to clone, okay, but also cloning proves, or is the real proof, that every cell has all of the DNA that's needed, or what we call genomic equivalence. All cells, with a few exceptions, okay, I don't think you guys have talked about B and T cells yet, but with a few exceptions, other than those, all cells have all of the DNA. The same DNA that is in the zygote when you first have fertilization is also in the other cell that is used, or you couldn't get Dolly. So this is really the proof of that. Okay. So, we would like to be able to reprogram cells at whim. So one of the possibilities is to clone. It's not so easy, the numbers aren't so great. The numbers are getting greater as the years go by for Dolly. We haven't managed yet to do it for humans. But there are a few other places where we could trying to get cells that are more pluripotent, maybe not as pluripotent as an egg cell, right, but more pluripotent, or more, like let's say just a progenitor cell, and try to get it to, or ES cells from the ICM, try to get them to form, let's say, organs, or human, or whatever, right? We're trying to find other places where we could get sources of new organs for people who need transplants. And so we look, what we see is that we could use cloning, which is very difficult, but possible. And I'm going to discuss, I'd like to discuss those possibilities. On the back of 13B, you'll see that there are really kind of four choices. Okay, so the one we already, one of the choices is that we could take embryos that have developed up to the blastocyst stage, which you see here in A, remove cells from that inner cell mass, those cells that would normally become the embryo, put them in a petri dish, and give them specific molecules that will cause them to become, let's say, heart cells. Okay? And this could be very useful. For example, someone who's had a heart attack, let's say 20% of their left ventricle died because didn't get oxygen. If you could then cause these cells to become heart cells and inject them, and have it integrate and become part of the muscle, you could possibly save their lives. Their life. Okay? That's one possibility. Another possibility is if you took primordial germ cells before mitosis, so that they're still 2N, and did that same procedure. Because, right, the primordial germ cells are a special case, but they also stay pluripotent. The third possibility is to use adult stem cells. You see here in C, one of the problems with that is that they usually, most of those stem cells are not pluripotent, they're more committed and have progressed further down the various steps of commitment that I discussed over there on the board, steps 1 through 5. And then the last one that's written here, D, is therapeutic cloning, is really utilizes somatic nuclear transfer. Then you get an ICM, and you take those cells, which are pluripotent, and induce them to become heart cells, for example. Why? How is this different? And what is the advantage of this over A, okay, where we just took ICM cells from an embryo? And the real advantage is that if you know that this person had a heart attack, and you take a nucleus from a cell from this person, and you did somatic nuclear transfer, all of these cells would create the same proteins as all of the cells of this person are creating, because it has the same DNA, right? Which means that there'd be no immunorejection. You could inject cells, and you wouldn't have any problems with the immune system rejecting those cells because they would express the exact same proteins that all the other cells in that body express, because they contain the same DNA. So that's the big advantage to D.
You still require a blastocyst to insert an egg.
Because somatic nuclear transfer is into an egg. Okay. So you take a somatic nucleus and insert it into an egg.
Not exactly, but an egg.
Right, because you want to get rid of DNA, so you're not looking at fertilized. You want to get rid of all the previous DNA and have the DNA that's going to make the nucleus be the same DNA as is in this person, so that when you put it back into this person, there'll be no immune rejection. Okay? So, all right. So I've used as my example if a person has a heart attack. So what normally happens when a person has a heart attack? One of the vessels that gives blood to their heart becomes blocked, maybe even 2, maybe 3, depends how unlucky you are. And a certain number, let's say a certain portion of the left ventricle, which pumps the blood to the heart, dies. Let's say 20% dies. Cells called macrophages come and eat up those cells, and an extracellular matrix protein called collagen invades that region, forms what we call a scar. Okay, the same way you have a scar on your skin, which is also collagen, the same thing happens in your heart. You get a scar. That scar doesn't beat. Now, heart cells primarily do not proliferate. Okay? There's a little bit of proliferation that just is to replace those cells during your lifetime, but in general we say that heart cells do not proliferate. In general, you rarely hear about someone who had cancer of the heart because they don't proliferate and they're pretty much turned off, the cell cycle. So what happens is that the cells that are left over now have to pump the same amount of blood, but 20% of them are gone. So if the first heart attack didn't kill you, okay, let's say you're still alive with the 80% of the cells you have left, each of those cells grows, okay, and becomes larger. Those cells then are more taxed. They have to work harder. And what frequently happens is that the cells around that scar then die. So now you have 30% of the heart that is dead, and that then frequently will end up killing you. And so what happens is if you don't die from the initial heart attack, you may die within the next month or two from the regions around the scar dying also. So this is a real problem, okay? And we'd love to be able to reprogram cells to become heart cells, inject them into your heart, have them integrate into your heart and have a beating heart and recover, okay? What we do know how to do nowadays, there was an article where they took, in a rat, they took cells that they had done somatic nuclear transfer, injected them into the heart, and those cells beat, okay? But they didn't integrate with the other cells, so they had two different beats, okay? So they haven't managed to make it that they can get one heartbeat that will recover. So researchers look for ways or various possibilities about how else we could make heart cells, okay, new heart cells. So we talked about the fact that we could try to get, we could do cloning, but that of course is making a whole new human, right? We could try to take the ES cells and drive them down a heart lineage, or we could think about trying to get the heart cells that are left to regenerate or to make other heart cells that are missing. And we can look at lower vertebrates as a great example of that. We see, for example, that a salamander can regenerate its leg. A frog can regenerate some of its retinal axons. So if we look at zebrafish, we see that they can regenerate their spinal cords, their fins, their retina, and it turns out also part of their heart. So what they did was they took and they cut off the bottom 20% of the zebrafish heart. Blood starts gushing out, of course. A clot starts to form, okay? A certain extracellular matrix protein arrives that's called fibrin, okay? The fibrin arrives, you get a clot, and you see that slowly but surely there is proliferation, and the 20% that is missing is regenerated, okay? So they look to see, okay, so we've got regeneration here, but not in the human. Let's see what happens if we mutate one of the genes called MPS1, if we mutate this gene, which is important in the progression of the cell cycle, okay, so that the cell cycle cannot progress, what do they see? That in the zebrafish, you then do not get regeneration of the heart. You get invasion of collagen into this region, and instead a scar forms. So one of the hopes would be that we would manage in humans to activate or to enable the proliferation to occur by activating one of these progression genes that enable the cell cycle to progress, and so as a result be able to shift the balance and cause proliferation instead of scarring. Now, of course, there is a danger to that. If you would totally just turn on, you know, one of the genes that's important in the progression, you might cause the proliferation to be so great that you would get cancer. This would have to be very fine-tuned so that you would turn it on a little bit more so that if you needed it in the case of a heart attack, it would work, but not so much that you'd start getting cancer of the heart or massive proliferation of the heart. Okay? Yes? So you're saying when a cell divides into two, that is proliferation.
Is that proliferation?
Yes. Yes.
So when the lifespan of the heart is they don't proliferate?
Long. And that's why there is some, they say that usually there's about 1% that are, about 1% of the cells are being replaced, but that it's very little and not definitely not enough to replace 20% that just died in a heart attack.
The MPS1 gene, is that a transcription factor? What kind of What gene is that?
Well, you haven't talked about checkpoint genes yet, so I called it a gene that was important in the progression, but it's you may talk about it. Okay. And so I'll see you on Tuesday. Now, anything that I didn't get to in the PowerPoint presentation, right, inference and chromosome activation, you will not be responsible for.